10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
We are devoting today's morning show to discussion of a powerfully thought-provoking book that I, frankly, am still digesting, a book which is titled Faith, Nationalism, and the Future of Liberal Democracy. The book is an examination of the way in which religious faith, or maybe more specifically, religious identity is impacting our political life, and in particular, the way it is having deep impact here in the United States and also in a number of different countries in Europe, and the way in which religious identity is becoming an increasingly powerful factor in our collective political life and our political discourse. And this really, really fascinating book is a collaboration from several different people, but chiefly the work of Dr. David Elcott, who is the Taub Professor of Practice in Public Service and Leadership at the Wagner School of Public Service at NYU. And he, along with several other colleagues, have done meticulous research and written a truly engrossing book that is also certainly unsettling as it paints a picture of liberal democracy under attack in many places or otherwise in various ways showing vulnerability. And it also points the way to perhaps different means by which religious leaders and theologians can find language with which to enter this discussion and debate on the nature of liberal democracy and the importance of preserving it. This book gave me a lot to talk about, to think about, and to talk about today in this conversation. The book is published, again, by the University of Notre Dame Press, Faith, Nationalism, and the Future of Liberal Democracy. Professor David Elcott, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great being here. Thank you.
I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. This is a book that springs not only from your work, but from several other colleagues. And I'm not finding it now, but I made a note of the description of this small team of, let's call them co-authors, as an intergenerational team. And there's even more than that that make you an interesting group. Tell our listeners a little bit about those who collaborated with you on this book and the nature of that collaboration.
The original fantasy of the book was to actually cover other religions as well, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and I actually had a wonderful array of authors writing chapters. Getting such a massive volume published became too difficult and too onerous. And so we ended up with this smaller this smaller book, although we referenced throughout the book using the words of these people I had asked to write, using their words as well. So originally, our goal was to cover the whole world. Well, covering the whole world, as you can imagine, is a massive effort, and said more than we could handle. Each two of the three people who wrote, each one wrote one chapter, are scholars with whom I've worked. Volker Harman, I met when he was actually a graduate student in Tübingen in Germany, and I was a visiting guest professor there, lecturer there, and we met at that time. He was studying both for his doctorate and to be a minister, and he then came to Harvard, and so he became what we say in Hebrew is a ben bayit, literally a son of the household. He used to come and visit and be with us, and of course in the interim he has a position in the Evangelical Church of Germany. So that's a long-standing relationship, long-standing disagreements we have about the nature of Christianity, Judaism, but very close as well. And Colt Anderson and I met. He's at Fordham. He was then the dean of the religious School of Religion at Fordham. And he worked with me on the collaborations that took place before the book, trying to think about ways to engage faith communities across a range of boundaries, whether it was different religions or within different religions, different theologies, or if within different religions and theologies, different politics. We remained close. He's just a brilliant thinker and incredibly articulate. The third person, Tobias Kremer, came in the most wonderful ways. I was seeking a European political scientist slash religious philosophy. And in searching, a number of people mentioned this young scholar finishing his PhD at Cambridge, German-born, fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, ministers in the church. And we met each other virtually, of course, because that's the way the world was. And just this wonderful, bright, thoughtful young man who had a master's of public affairs from Harvard, finishing the PhD in political science, got his BA in politics at the Sorbonne, so quite global citizen. And he wrote the chapter on Europe. So we collaborated. I did not meet Volker and did not meet Tobias in person until actually the book was written and ready to go out. And he came to the United States and stayed with us. And that was wonderful. So it was really an interesting collaboration. He was finished PhD, a young academic in his 20s. I'm far and away the oldest at 70. So we really, it was interfaith, intergenerational, also geographically dispersed, and coming with different academic fields. So the goal of the book was to try to bridge all of those in the writing as well, to feel kind of a greater sense of depth in the work that we did.
One line in your book that leapt out at me was this. You wrote, "It is critical that this volume models respect for religious and political diversity and for constructive and respectful civil discourse." There's a lot wrapped up in those words, but at the heart of it, it would seem that, you know, you wanted not to make the mistake of staking out this is right and this is wrong, and this is what you should think about the world. You want to allow for a wide range of possibilities while making some very strong and firm conclusions about how the world and particularly how democracy best functions. But could you just say a word about the care you took to try to write a book that would model respect for diverse opinions, including opinions other than your own? And how difficult was that?
The initial imagination of this book came from research I did by traveling around the country and doing surveys and focus groups and interviews with religious folk from across the denominations of Christianity. So going from the most progressive United Church of Christ, which you name the issue and they have a liberal view of it, to evangelical churches deep in the South, in what is called redneck country. As well, so evangelical churches, Catholic churches, mainstream Protestant churches. And in doing that, what was curious was, in what ways can we communicate across boundaries that otherwise feel impermeable? And I can tell you an experience in one of the evangelical churches, a white church, very, very conservative. You could predict exactly how each of them would vote or what their policy would be on all the major social issues facing the country. And they spoke, and it was very interesting. And then they said, well, kind of, who are you? And I said, well, I'm a professor, I'm Jewish. And I said, I read the Bible in the original. Well, that was very, very exciting for them. So they said, can you preach? And so I taught a text from the Book of Kings. It's a piece of the story of the prophet Elijah, who's in a cave. And he says to God, I'm alone. I'm the only one. No one cares. I'm going to die. I'm abandoned. This is the end. And God says, go out to the mouth of the cave. And there was thunder and lightning, and there was an earthquake, and there was trembling, and then there was a still small voice. And the voice says, Elijah, don't worry, I'm with you. It's going to be all right. Elijah goes back in the cave, and word for word, he repeats the soliloquy that preceded this extraordinary theophany. I'm the only one, I'm alone, no one cares. That was what I preached. And then they began to speak, and they said, maybe we are arrogant to think that we're the only people of faith. Maybe we have to listen better and be less judgmental and listen to others. And then they said the most remarkable thing. They said, two generations ago in this church, it was taught that God wants segregation and that Black people are inferior. And today, we have family members of all different races. Maybe our children will say to us about same-sex marriage what prior generations said about segregation. And I realized from that, do I think that they voted differently or they changed? Probably not. But it did make me aware of openness that is possible. The tragedy for me is that I wanted to go back to these churches after 7 years and see what's happened. And I went and tried to get them to participate again. And almost everyone said no, some didn't even answer. So that the polarization is even more severe. And what does that mean, the polarization is severe? It means that we can't even listen to the story of the other. Simply hearing an alternative story to our own is so threatening and so infuriating that we have to silence it. And that comes from both sides these days. It's not only from the right that is silencing anything other than hearing their own voices, but it's also now coming from the left. And that is really a tragedy and a reality that none of us want to face, which is it is such a deep degree of polarization that we can't even do what South Africa did in their Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where at least they could listen to each other.
Hmm. Wow. One other kind of overarching question before we dig into some specifics in your book. You mentioned before we went on the air the extraordinary circumstances under which you both wrote this text and finalized it. And of course, a lot of the final writing of this book took place during the COVID-19 pandemic and other really dramatic events, which I think, if I understood you correctly, actually necessitated the rewriting of the opening of the book and maybe other portions of the book as well. Can you just explain a little bit about how current events had a very direct and tangible impact on the final words as they appear on the page?
of course, as a historian, I always have to go back, right? In this case, it's the personal, it's autobiographical. My mom fled Germany as a teenager by herself, came illegally to the United States as not only a legal alien, but actually an enemy alien, because she came from Germany. And even though she was Jewish, she was still considered in the United States during World War II as an enemy alien, working in a factory to protect herself. Most of my family was murdered in World War II. So as a first generation American, with that type of history, it's very easy to go to dark places. It's very easy to see more danger perhaps than really is out there. And I have to say that in some way is what impelled me to begin this journey that ends up in this book, which is that, in 1923, there was the Munich Putsch, in which Adolf Hitler tried a rebellion, and he was arrested and put in jail along with his comrades. He wrote Mein Kampf. The Weimar Republic proudly stood up and said, see, democracy prevailed. But 10 years later, he was the Chancellor of Germany. So during these past years, it was easy to, and I have to say, part of the rhetoric and the behaviors of the Trump administration gave me pause. That there were not, it wasn't just policies. We can disagree on policies, but it was the language, the violent rhetoric, the attempt to undermine the press, using actually language that came from the far right, language that was no different than the language used by the dictators in the middle of the last century. The press, that the press is the enemy of the people, or that those others are the enemy of the people. They'll bring on the destruction. So on one hand, I had that great fear. The other side, I do have to say, is that I realized that for many Americans and for many around the world, there is this deep sense of loss, this deep sense that they're losing their identities, they're losing their culture. This country into which I was born isn't the same country any longer. That globalization has been wonderful for a small group of elites, but for me, it's nothing but loss. As Arlie Hochschild's line, that I've been standing, waiting patiently to get my turn of the American dream, and all these other people jump in front of me. Jews jump in front of me. Blacks jump in front of me. LGBTQ jump in front of me. Now even illegal immigrants, illegal aliens coming into our country jump in front of me. So what do I have in front of me? I only have loss. So in seeing that, I realized that my progressive views, my views about the nature of democracy and caring for the widow and the orphan and the stranger in our midst, for those most marginalized, for those oppressed, that for others in America, they said, no, that's us. We're the ones who are oppressed. We're the ones who are suffering loss. And I think that many politicians and theologians tapped into that pain. And that's why we talk about this populist nationalism that's fueled not by religion, but by religious identity. It's not by people who go to mass, or Muslims who put their forehead to the ground during prayer, or Jews who put on phylacteries, put on tefillin on their arms. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people who use religious identity to justify why these other people don't belong in our country anymore. And that, I think, became the core of the book, shared by my fellow authors.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with David Elcott, who is on the faculty at the Wagner School of Public Service at NYU, and the primary author of a book called Faith, Nationalism, and the Future of Liberal Democracy. I don't think we should go any further without having you clarify those last two words of the title of the book. And of all of the words we see in your book, save if, and, or but, probably we see liberal democracy and illiberal democracy used the most. I think that distinction is extremely important, particularly given the fact that the word liberal gets thrown around so carelessly, and in particular is often used in a way that really has nothing to do with what you're talking about here. Please clarify the difference between liberal and illiberal democracy.
So let's delve into the political history of America. When we talk about democracy, many of us would say, well, democracy, that's one person, one vote, that's majority rule. So 50.5% versus 49.5%, we have a victor, that victor has won, and that person who's won gets to implement the policies that person believes are the most important, most effective. That's one side, but there's a different side of liberal democracy, of democracy, which we inherited from the British and put more foremost into our Constitution. And that's the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And fundamentally that says the government does not have a role to play in my personal life, and that it has to limit itself. And that kind of the government that governs least governs best. And to do that, it means we need to protect the rights, the human rights and the civil rights of everyone living within our country. In fact, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution makes that pretty explicit. It says that full rights belong to anyone residing within the borders of this country. Now, at the time, that was actually to protect slaves, people who were enslaved, who became free, making sure that they had full rights, and that's the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. But it also meant that if somebody is in this country, even not legally, they have the protections of law. So the second understanding of democracy in America was the protection of individual rights. There is a third, and we have to accept, a third grounding of America that was Christian, because the people coming to this country, fleeing Europe, came for religious freedom. Now, ironically, in most cases, it meant that I should be free in Massachusetts Bay Colony in one way, and in Rhode Island Quakers another way, and in Georgia as a Catholic another way. And it was mainly to allow me to have my freedom, although even within my community, I may have restrictions for the people living within that community. But it was seen, America was seen, and when you look at the names of cities across the United States, you can hear it. America came as the new Jerusalem, as the new Israel, as really a fulfillment of God's plan for America. We hear it all the time. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord was the way that Union soldiers marched to war. And when we sing, God bless America, God shed your grace on thee, right? That we have to recognize that to a great degree, America is seen as God's beloved country. And for many Christians, that also means that while others can live in our country, we have the right, as a majority of Christians, we have the right to sustain a Christian liberalism, a Christian democracy, rather. So Viktor Orban, who is the prime minister in Hungary, he says, I'm not talking about religion. I'm not asking whether or not you go to church. But let's understand that Hungarians are Christian, that the culture we have, the political system that developed, was one that merged Christianity with the other national identities. And that's the same in Germany. So a Muslim who has been a Turkish Muslim whose great-grandfather came to Germany, this person was born in Germany, can live in Germany, but don't mistake living there for assuming that the culture should be indifferent to the fact that Germany was grounded in Christianity. And by the way, I want to be clear, That is exactly what you hear the Jewish majority saying in Israel about Jews. It's exactly what you hear Prime Minister Modi saying in India, in which he is turning a great Muslim edifice, he's turning into a museum to prove that India was always Hindu. It's the same thing you hear in Myanmar when the horrible pillage and attacks on Muslims living within Myanmar. And it's the same thing you hear in Indonesia when they imprisoned the Christian mayor of Jakarta for blasphemy, right? So it's not just in the United States. We are seeing this resurgence bubbling up of merging religious identity with nationalist populism. And that's what illiberal democracy is about. Liberal democracy argues that you have to defend the rights of all citizens, civil and human rights. It says you have to protect the integrity of the institutions of the country, of the press. You have to validate the fact that I have won this election, but I may lose the next one. Right. In the book, James Carr talks about finite and infinite gains. Democracy is meant to be an infinite game. I win this one, but the next time we play, I may lose. Turning it to a finite game, which means the absolute destruction of the other side. You win the game and the game is permanently over. That's illiberal democracy. Hmm.
That's a very striking passage in the book. You write, in a normal and healthy democracy, there is a tension, an infinite game where one never wins permanently, and the system has a range of checks and balances to keep the game going, to keep the game alive and vital. Yet autocrats and autocratic political movements seek to permanently win or end the game with total victory and, in essence, shut down the game. I think until I read those words, I did not maybe fully grasp the mindset of some that in this current situation in which we are so drastically polarized and where the language is especially raw and negative, it goes beyond just kind of feelings for the other side, but there is this sense that it is a different kind of victory that is being sought here. That was really eye-opening to me. How is it that religious identity becomes such a powerful tool towards that end? Why is it that one might turn to religious identity and utilize that as opposed to other tools that might be at one's disposal?
So if you think in the United States, if you think about who is here and who belongs, who's authentically American and who isn't, race is one cut of that, which is white on one side, black, brown, Asian on the other side, right? That race is incredibly critical, but it's not enough that race is critical because, for example, there are Jews who are white. There are Muslims who are white, right? There are Buddhists who are white. And so it's not cutting enough in terms of the understanding of authenticity. So instead you have this cut which says in America you have to be white and Christian. That's the real American. And by the way, there's some truth in that. We're socialized into this culture. If you close your eyes and say, who is a real American? What image comes to mind? It isn't going to be somebody who's black with dreadlocks. It's not going to be somebody who's got a long beard and a kippah, head covering on his head. That's not what's going to come to mind. I'll tell you, sometimes in my classes, I put different words around the room. Sexual identity, gender, race, ethnicity, nationality, right? I'll put different things around the room and say to students, stand in the one that's most salient for you. Who gets stuck? White, 6 foot tall guys who are Christian. Why? Because when they see ethnicity, they're thinking of Mexican or African or Chinese, because they have what's called the unmarked position. Theirs is not an ethnicity, theirs is what's real American. When they see religion, they're gonna see other religions. They're not gonna see their Christianity. When they see sexual identity, they're not going to see straight, they're gonna see gay, they're gonna see trans, because what they are is the authentic, unmarked position, right? So religion becomes critical in America. It has been historically, and it has been used repeatedly to mobilize. We saw that in the 1920s, from the 1880s till the 1920s, 30s, to World War II. We had a brief hiatus where our courts and our legislatures and the values in America said, no, no, we're all one, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. At that point, we didn't talk about Hindus, Muslims, or Buddhists. We are all the same. We all, or as the Secretary of State said in the 1950s, I don't care what religion you are as long as you go to church on Sunday. And that was kind of the view. In Europe, in Israel, in India, in Muslim countries, in Buddhist countries, it actually, religion looms even larger, right? So it doesn't matter if you're black or brown, you know, it's the authentic Christianity that matters, the authentic Islam, the authentic Hinduism or Judaism. And again, I want to note, we're not talking about piety. We're not talking about how many times you go to church or whether you keep halal or kosher. We're not talking about that at all. In fact, one of Tobias's awarenesses in his research is that the more faithful you are going to church in Germany, the less likely you will support the illiberal democratic parties. The more you go to church, the more faithful you are, the more likely you will only support the democratic parties.
So yes, this is, it's a distinction that's really important, and you make it clearly and repeatedly in your book that we're not talking as much about religious faith or religious belief as we are talking about religious identity, the way that religion acts as a point of identity. This is written at one point. In terms of its political meaning, it is not about one's belief or one's faithfulness to church, synagogue, temple, or mosque. It is more about a secularized faith, faith as culture, civilizational and identitarian, religion of belonging rather than believing, a way of defining the we against the they, who are alien and dangerous. First of all, I think it's a point that I certainly do not dispute, but I think you would agree that that's probably something about which we have to be kind of careful in how we characterize it, because there are certainly plenty of people whose religious beliefs are far from irrelevant to them and far from irrelevant in terms of the political choices they make. So it's not that you are talking about every person, you know, kind of within this body, having beliefs or faith that are inconsequential, but maybe it's more of the collective force we're talking about, religious identity versus religious belief. Look, would that be a helpful distinction?
So if I would ask you, what's at the core of Christianity, right? What's at the core of Christianity? What would you say?
Are you asking me to answer?
Yeah. What would you say is the core of Jesus' message?
Right. For me, it would probably be love one another as I have loved you.
Right. And you know what? All Christians would say that. that Jesus preached love, non-judgmentalism, right? He was the one who could go to the prostitute, could go to someone who's a leper, could go to the person in pain and offer to heal and offer a hand, right? That's been the core, that's the core message of Christianity. So a Christianity that is triumphalist, a Christianity that denies rights to other people, a Christianity that preaches a level of hatred and anger. And I would say the same about Jews. When I look when I hear Jews marching in the streets screaming Mavat la'aravim, death to Arabs, and I say to myself, something is deeply wrong. So I would probably push back on this and say, if you're filled with hate, it is very hard to argue that you are a faithful Christian. You may have a Christmas tree. You may even go to church sometimes. It's just hard to imagine that with that level of hatred, you could say you are a true Christian, you are a follower of Jesus. And I think that much of the book is also saying to Christian ministers, priests, to rabbis, to imams, to say to them, it's time to speak up for the real faith that you want to preach. It's time to not be afraid of that. Part of what drove me to do this interfaith work was this feeling that God had been hijacked. You know, I'm not sure about exactly what I believe, but I do know that the God that I believe is significant in the world is not one that preaches hatred.
Right.
It's not one that preaches separation, that preaches that I have the right to destroy others. Now, all the religious movements at various points in their history were in a sense totalitarian. We know what God wants. We speak for God. But I think in our century, we have a deeper understanding that to say I know God's will is really a form of blasphemy, right? It is a heresy.
It diminishes God.
I now own God. And we have to accept that there is a very wide gap between whatever God's will may be in plan and what we know. And it's in that, however large we can make that opening, that we should be able to speak to each other across faiths, across ethnicities, across nationalities, right, across race, across sexual identity, because we have to be somewhat modest and recognize whatever piece of God I feel I understand, I have to know that to absolutize that is what, you know, when in the Bible, what Pharaoh did, right? Pharaoh is God, and that caused enormous suffering for the Egyptians, but it also was an effort to understand, no, each of us has a piece, but none of piece of the puzzle of the whole, and none of us have the whole puzzle.
And you touch on some of that in the last chapter of the book, which we'll touch on in just a moment. Back to this point of religion being used as a way to create even a sharper delineation between us and them, which is what you're talking about at many points in the book. I think one of the questions that arises from that then is, are you asking people or hoping that people will discard that notion of we, us, or we versus them? Because that would be a painful thing for probably a lot of people to give up, in the sense that we derive great meaning from that and comfort and so on from being part of a we. Is there a positive way that we can be part of we, or by its very nature, when it's us and them, are we talking about something that is inherently destructive and counterproductive?
Look, I think it's deeply human to make distinctions. I think that is one of the features of intelligence, of consciousness, that we identify difference. Babies at a very early age can identify something that looks dangerous to them. So clearly I understand there is a human, part of what allowed us to survive was understanding danger and translating often danger into enemy. So in no way would I diminish seeing at our core of relationship is family. Part of the growth of humanity was to be part of a tribe and say, somebody else's child, I can take care of that child too, not only my own. And suddenly we can have a larger community. All the religions really have a vision, and democracy itself has a vision that says we are even more than that, that humanity is even more than that. So in no way should we diminish the love that I have for my children. This is not a nice thing to say, but way back in the 70s when I was first married, we lived in Berkeley for a little while, and it was a place that loved humanity but made really crummy neighbors, right? That you can't say I love humanity if you can't love individually, if you aren't able to love your own child, your nephews, your nieces, right? The people who are in my church, in my synagogue, in my mosque, in my temple. So yes, I can feel closer to them, but I should be able to learn from that closeness that I can be more expansive, right? That I can be more expansive than that. And that in fact, human beings are remarkably interesting. We all have interesting stories to tell, and I've got something to gain by hearing your story. Hopefully you have something to gain by hearing mine. And it may be really strange and different, but in hearing that, I can widen myself. You know, that's how we have marriage equality in the United States, that suddenly people began seeing, well, wait a moment, that's my nephew. And he really loves this guy. This is my neighbor's daughter. And she is so in love with this friend who's a woman. Right, I've got to now hear that differently. Right after the horrendous murder of George Floyd, Black Lives Matter had an approval rate, people were behind it, at two-thirds of our country. There was this brief moment of humanity. I could see that could have been my child, that could have been my father, and I could see that color didn't matter, religion didn't matter, right? I could see it briefly, and then we closed down once again. We panic once again. And honestly, illiberal democracy, this type of use of religious identity is one of panic, is one of fear, is one of loss. And again, to use religious language, God's bounty is huge. It's huge. The promise in the world is huge, and democracy offers us that opportunity. Illiberal democracy shuts us down, fills us with fear, fills us with anger. We're seeing it right now in this country.
Right.
Seeing it right now, and heaven knows it's like in balance.
And I appreciate the fact that one of the points you make in the book, and you've already made this point in this interview, is that generally speaking, many of us are not doing a very good job of understanding those who feel this kind of fear and or feel this sense of being utterly left behind. And one thing that needs to happen is more of an understanding and appreciation of that reality. And to talk about that openly. I think you very persuasively make that point in your book. But I think we need to, in the closing minutes, talk about how the book ends with some really intriguing words of promise in terms of ways in which some of these conversations, and in fact, in part, to exactly address some of those sense of fear, of being marginalized and so on, of how the world of religion has something very important to offer. Explain to our listeners what they find in the sixth chapter of your book.
So I recognize that fewer Americans, fewer Europeans go to church, go to synagogue than ever in our history. I understand that. The largest growth religion in America is none. I understand that's N-O-N-E, not N-U-N, right? I understand that. That doesn't mean, though, that people don't have or seek faith, that people don't have a deep desire to believe something. And as religious leaders cloister themselves, diminish their voice out of anxiety, out of fear, out of panic, how it will divide their community, how it will cause conflict, that's the wrong move, right? It needs to be the opposite move. Americans have enormous respect for faith leaders. You see it at the inauguration, you see it at the opening of Congress, you see it that generally there'll be some person, religious leader, clergy, speaking at an event that's important. Certainly when you think of civil rights, you can't imagine it without the Black church. You can't imagine it without the Catholic Church and other Protestant and Jews engaged in civil rights as religious folk. So even if people don't go to church, I want to utilize that religious identity in a different way. If you believe in Christian identity, then let that be a rich Christianity, the Christianity of Jesus. If you believe in Jewish identity, then let it be the one that talks about ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, right? If you are Muslim, then it's an Islam in which Muhammad preached peace over war is always better, right? So for me, at the very moment in which we need faith leaders to be brave, to stand up, to speak for democracy, to develop a theology of democracy that's authentic to their own religious tradition, I worry that they don't have the guts to do that. And so this book was meant to hopefully inspire and encourage people of faith, leaders of faith, to be able to utilize that for good, not for evil. Hmm.
The book is very, very powerful, and I hope many, many people will seek it out. Again, it's titled Faith, Nationalism, and the Future of Liberal Democracy, published by the University of Notre Dame Press. And its lead author, Professor David Elcott. Professor Elcott, I was really honored to speak with you today. I found your book deeply engrossing, and it gave me all kinds of things to deeply reflect upon. And I know everyone who reads it will experience it in the same way. So I thank you for writing this book and for being part of the morning show today.
Wonderful being with you. Thank you so much. Best of luck.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we are honored to have back on the program Dr. John Swallow, who is the president of Carthage College. We will take a few minutes to look back on a most challenging school year and how Carthage came through the challenges of COVID-19 and what is planned for this upcoming academic year. On Friday's Morning Show, we'll speak with John Winkle, who is the interim executive director of the Racine Symphony Orchestra. They have a Lakeside Pops concert that is coming up later in June. And we will also be talking about the hopes and dreams of the Racine Symphony for the future. Also on Friday, a really interesting conversation with a woman in the fashion industry by the name of Lauren Cochran. And her book is called The Ten. And it examines the history of 10 iconic pieces of clothing, things like the trench coat or the miniskirt or something as simple and basic as the white t-shirt. It's surprisingly fascinating book. I really enjoyed every page. And you'll hear my conversation with